this third hour, Friday edition of the Hagman Report. We got a fantastic guest lined up who's on with us right now, Mr. Jeff Yago. Jeff is a licensed engineer, an NABCEP certified solar professional, and a certified energy professional with more than 40 years of experience working in the energy and emergency power field. He's a regular contributor to the Backwoods Home Magazine and has contributed to Home Power Magazine and Mother Earth News. Yago is committed to energy independence and lives outside of Richmond, Virginia. He's also the author of a book titled Lights On. Now, folks who are familiar with the WorldNet Daily Superstore, folks go to HagmanReport.com, and at the very top of the page, there is the WorldNet Daily Superstore banner. Use the promo code Hagman and get Jeff Yago's book, Lights On. Lights On has the solution. Energy expert Jeff Yago lays out the lost history of early residential battery powder and delves into just how durable and universal battery power devices are. And we are going to talk about a number of scenarios, from the EMP threat to what's going on with North Korea, the vulnerabilities in our energy infrastructure, and much more, as well as solutions that are offered in the book Lights On, and things that we can do to minimize the potential disaster of an EMP, or what we learned this week is also called a black sky event. And I don't know that we talked about that on this show yet, but we can get into that a little bit today, as there is a simulated black sky event going to happen. I believe it's August 23rd, if I remember right. We talked about it on the Hagman Daily Show yesterday. Mr. Yago, welcome to the Hagman Report.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate you guys having me on. We are, both my wife and I, are regular listeners, and certainly very familiar with your program and your audience.
Well, that's awesome to hear. John was telling me about you and your wife having been listeners to the show, and that's we think that's just awesome. And whatever sound issues we were having before we came on air have disappeared, so we won't have to reconnect. Everything sounds good. So you wrote a book called Lights On. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself, and then we'll jump right into some of the issues that we're facing today.
Well, I'm like I said, I'm a licensed consulting engineer, and I've got about 40 years experience working in other countries and all over the United States on all types of projects involving backup power systems, solar power systems, grid issues. I've worked at secret military facilities dealing with backup power supplies. I've worked on solar projects from multi-million dollar systems for university buildings down to some guy with a shack in the woods for a bug out retreat, and everything in between, RVs, boats, you name it. So I feel like over the years I've accumulated pretty good knowledge, simply because I've probably done everything wrong you could possibly do over the years. When we started back in the late 60s, you know, there wasn't any books. We were kind of writing the books as we went along, and a lot of the solar manufacturers that you know today, I worked with them when they were, you know, when there was one or two guys working out of a garage, and you'd order a part, and they would call up a week later to see if it caught fire or not. So that's kind of where we all began.
Okay. And again, folks, our guest, Jeff Yago, go to the WorldNet Daily Superstore to get his book, Lights On. Use the promo code Hagman. Let's start with North Korea, Jeff, as this has been one of the most prevalent stories in the news over this last week, with the increased rhetoric between Trump and Kim Jong-il. And you say that the EMP is the weapon of choice for North Korea. With all these missile tests we see, why would you say that?
Well, I feel like that, of course, I'm not professing to be some expert in military, you know, pursuits, but just from an engineering standpoint, it doesn't make sense that China would allow North Korea to explode a nuclear bomb or take out a city in this country. It just, I think China looks at the United States as a future, something that they're going to own one of these days with all the debt that they have here and the fact that the Chinese are in the process of converting a lot of this debt into buying up properties and farmlands and infrastructure. And I don't think China wants to see the infrastructure of this country destroyed, which the detonation of a nuclear device certainly is not going to destroy the entire United States, but the, you know, radiation can impact a lot of this infrastructure for 100 years. So I think though China would be more than happy if North Korea exploded an EMP device, which of course does not in any way damage buildings or infrastructure. It just basically causes all of our interconnected electrical grid and phone systems and communication systems and transportation systems to fail. And one EMP device, if detonated above the United States and around the central part of the country, one device of a very low yield nuclear explosion can pretty much affect every city and town from the East Coast to the West Coast, whereas a nuclear bomb would certainly devastate a city, but it couldn't have the impact on everybody else that an EMP device could do.
Okay. And, you know, I've even long before we started this radio show, my father and I, we attended an EMP conference called One Second After, and this was in Buffalo, New York, maybe 10 years ago now. And we learned, you know, a lot about the threat of EMP as well as the solutions to be able to fix it. And I think back then they said if the U.S. would invest $5 billion into the infrastructure and the power grid, they could ground everything and basically protect it from the threat of EMP. Those steps have never been taken. Is it because that the leaders and people who make these decisions don't consider this a credible threat? Or do you believe that there is another reason why they have not hardened our power grid in order to prevent an EMP from having an effect?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. If my camera is on, I can show you some of the studies that have.
Oh yeah, we can see you.
Okay. For example, here's one study. Look how thick it is.
Yeah.
This was done in 2014. It's titled "Securing the U.S. Electrical Grid." This was done by the Center for the Study of Presidency and Congress. It included a number of senators and congressmen. And I mean, I've read this monster, and it's really well done. There's some of the very knowledgeable people, and they gave some really excellent solutions and things that needed to be done. Here's another one. This was done in 2012. Large power transformers and the U.S. electrical grid. This study was done by the U.S. Department of Energy. Here's one. This was dated 2013. Electric grid vulnerability. It was done by the U.S. House of Representatives. I've got stacks of these, and these are really good studies. They're well done, well documented, and every one of them have a number of what to do suggestions in the appendix. And some of these studies have been done since 2014. They're not old, and yet I'm not seeing, based on what they recommended, I haven't seen any evidence that anything's been done. I think this thing has been studied to death. I think that probably the two reasons nothing has been done is number one is the money. And number two, there's just a general apathy in this country that, well, this is never going to happen. But you have to remember other countries don't look at it that way. A lot of your other countries, Russia, China, Switzerland, I mean, these countries are heavily involved in helping to provide protection for their citizenry. They do think that these events can happen, and they do want to try to do something to protect their population. They're even using, you know, subways, underground facilities that can be hardened or at least provided backup food and water for large numbers of people. Well, in this country, during the Clinton administration, the final supplies and civil defense networks were shut down. All of those signs that, you know, I remember growing up that said, shelter on some of the larger buildings and parking garages, they've all been taken down. But it seems like most of the preparations this country has been doing is just for a continuation of government, COG. They're, mm-hmm. They certainly are doing preparations and making facilities available for the government, but not only are they not doing anything for the people, but I think they've made a decision years ago that it's just physically not possible for the government to be able to provide food and shelter and water for millions of people if we have a grid down event. They just say we just can't do it. So let's at least protect the government so we'll have a continuation of government once this thing is over. So I think it's apathy and just general, if the government is not out promoting these things to the population and you're not hearing it in the news, then most people are just not paying attention. I mean, I talk to people every day and the first thing I ask them is, do you even own a flashlight? And I'm just amazed at the number of people who don't even own a flashlight, or if they own one, they couldn't find it. Or if they found it, the kids have taken the batteries out of it for some toy. So something as inexpensive and simple as a flashlight, which could provide some real emergency assistance, they haven't even done that. So I think it's going to be a real wake-up call when something like this actually hits. And I do think it's going to hit. I just, I can't project when, but I do think it's going to be something that we are going to face, and that's my concern.
Well, piggybacking off of what you just said, and I know in the second segment we're going to get into a number of solutions that you talk about in your book, the basic preparations that Americans could take but have not or won't for whatever reason, do you think that is because we have been living in a society where we haven't faced the types of adversity that would lead people to go ahead and prepare for, terror? I mean, obviously we see localized disasters, even Hurricane Katrina is, a city statewide disaster. But is it that people are too comfortable and we have too many creature comforts that are always available to us for people to take action because they've never really lived through something where they needed these preparations? What do you think it is with our society that they just forego these preps?
Well, that's certainly a good point. I mean, the average person that has a house full of electrical equipment, they're never more than 12 feet away from a wall outlet, so they don't know where that electricity came from. They don't know, anything about it other than if they plug the device and it works. And so there's, they just are used to it working. And, as mentioned before, these potential problems for the grid, it's not just, the potential for an EMP attack. There's also the fact that we have 450,000 miles of power lines in the United States and 6,000 generating plants, and most of this stuff was installed in the 1970s. I mean, a lot of this infrastructure is just plain getting old. We're not investing in replacement, and so that's an issue. Hacking of the computer control systems that operate our utilities is certainly another concern. So I think the fact that, yes, we've had a very reliable grid for most people in this country for many years, and it has been reliable, but I think we have a false sense of security, and I think the future of this country, we're going to certainly see not only more power outages in more areas, but that they're going to last a lot longer. I'm not talking about, a two-day outage by a storm, or a week-long outage by something like, Hurricane Sandy or Katrina, but we're talking potentially these problems I've discussed could impact major parts of the United States for months, not days. You know, we have three major electric grids in the United States, and everybody thinks it's all connected, but it's not. I mean, Texas is basically by itself, and you have an eastern grid and a western grid, but there's not a wire that runs from California to Virginia, you know, that they can just transfer this power around if they need to. And so I do think, as you mentioned, that we've just gotten a little complacent and just always assume it's going to work, and, you know, until it doesn't.
Yeah, and you're right. And fortunately, when you brought up the issue of most Americans don't have a flashlight or don't know where it is, I have one flashlight in my house where I know where it is with the batteries ready to go. But beyond that, my preparations for an electrical type event, aside from having a little storable food and water, are not, you know, they wouldn't pass a basic preparations check. But and I believe that that's for most Americans, and that's why when they put the statistics out, if an EMP event happened, whether a weaponized event or a natural event, that 90% of Americans would die within a year. And I believe a lot of that is based on preparation, and then a lot of that would also be based on the crisis type panic situations we would find ourselves in.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was just reading a little story a couple of weeks ago that somebody went in to interview the people who were responsible for emergency preparations for New York City. And they were just asking, well, you know, do you have emergency preparations for this city? And they were very proud that they did. And they took the person into this big warehouse and showed them, you know, all of this rows and rows of food that, you know, meals ready to eat and bottled water. And they had, I think they were bragging that they had over 1.5 million servings of individual meal servings. But, you know, New York City's population is, you know, 8.5 million. Right now, you know, I mean, that would mean they would need 25,000 meals for one day. You know, they consume over 1 billion gallons of water a day. They have over 1 billion gallons of water to be pumped out in their sewage treatment systems. So if we lose the grid in a city, you're not just, the lights aren't just going to go out, especially in high rise buildings. There's no pumps are going to operate for sewage systems to pump the sewage away. That's pumps that are providing clean water into the city. You know, 25 million meals a day. And that's just New York City. I mean, if we're talking about a grid down event that might take out the East Coast, you know, you've got probably 6 cities in that area that are over several million. I mean, you don't want to be anywhere near a city. Mm-mm. If we have a grid down event. I mean, not even, you know, overnight, because so many people are going to be sitting there. They typically buy their meals when they go home from work at night. They don't have the space for a lot of storage. And so we're talking about people that are going to sit there in their apartments and just waiting for the government to come rolling up the street with food and bottled water, and they're not going to be there. It's just physically not possible.
And that's that's a pretty frightening reality to contemplate. Not because, you know, I mean, we can sit here and you know, think about all these different scenarios and ways things can go bad and the horrible situations we could find ourselves in. But the reason this is so important is because it's not just the threat of a weapon that can do this. We have any type of solar weather, you know, from the coronal mass ejections that can also create this. This can happen from a natural phenomenon. And if you think about, you know, even to an economic crash or collapse, we can rebuild from that. But if we're talking about a sustained, you know, power grid failure across the U.S., that's something that is going to, as you just laid out, will cause a drastic loss of life and just a horrible situation, which will take much longer to recover from, and so much could happen. You talk about China, the China component, and you point out that China has converted U.S. resources for a long time, whether it be food or minerals, and that they hold the mortgage on the U.S. debt. They do own the majority of our debt, aside from what we owe or own, and that they might want to repossess our land. And what better way to take over a country that's pretty much uninvadable due to the number of guns and people that are here and the military power, then to cripple it with a weapon that is leaving people fighting for their own survival, then to come in when, you know, after a month of people just trying to survive and struggling to survive, and then being able to take it over, it would be, you know, like a walk in the park. Between China and the hacking and North Korea and natural phenomenon or space weather, if you had to place a bet, would it be a combination of these things, or what? How do you see this playing out if it were to play out, we'll say, you know, in the next year?
I think we're going to see an EMP event. I think it's going to impact about half the United States, but I don't know that I would say within the next year. I you know, I'm not privy to
right
to that level of what's going on.
But that's my time.
I would certainly think in the next few years, it's, if we keep going the way we're going, especially with North Korea and China's hacking and the other things that are going on, I've been talking about. I do think, not the entire country, but at least half the country. Just as a kind of a reference point, back in July in 1977, I know a lot of people weren't even maybe born then that are listening, but in 1977 in July, New York City, it was a very hot night, very humid. They had had a earlier storm. And about 9 at night, they lost one of their power generating plants from a lightning strike. Lightning struck a substation and took it out. And so when Con Edison operators were trying to reroute power, they had a second lightning strike about 15 minutes later that took out a second substation. And then about 15 minutes later, they had a third lightning strike. It took out a third one. And at that point, they contacted their backup generating facilities. And it was about 9:30 at night. Well, all the guys had gone home. There wasn't anybody there to start up the generators. So the system started to lose more and more of its capacity. And so they started diverting load over to New Jersey. They have a couple of power lines coming up in New Jersey, which is typical of today. And those got overloaded, and the New Jersey power operators had to shut those lines down. At that point, Con Edison operators had to shut down the whole system. Now, by midnight, basically the entire island of New York City was absolutely dark. Very little of the United States knew about it because most of your TV and radio production facilities were within the city. But in that one night, it is actually a 25-hour period it took them to get it back to operation. In one night, there was over 1,600 stores burned. There was 450 people arrested. There was just, you know, like $300 million worth of damage in 1977, you know, dollars.
Yeah.
It was just extensive damage in one night.
I just
and
saw,
we're not even talking.
Jeff, I'm sorry to interrupt, but just the other day on the Weather Channel, I saw a half-hour documentary about this. I don't know why I was watching the Weather Channel or what happened, but I saw this documentary that talked about this and then compared those scenarios that happened in 77 to if that same thing happened today, would they have the same results? And they talked about, you know, how the power grid's much more sound and more connected, and the lightning strikes wouldn't have the effect on it. But the amount of damage that you're talking about, they didn't really get into that, but they showed the pictures of, you know, police cars burning and people in the streets and the looting. And that's one night in one city, as you said. And that's just
right
from a lightning strike.
They stole all the cars off of a car lot, but they didn't steal them to drive them away. They used them to hook chains on to pull the security fencing off the front of these stores. Hmm. I mean, it was just massive. You know, they had to reroute the air traffic that was going into LaGuardia and Kennedy. And I mean, it was a war zone. And now again, one night in one city, a grid down event is going to impact a number of cities. It's not going to be isolated like that one problem was back then. And of course, they told you that everything has been fixed. Well, in 2003,
yep.
There was the power company in Ohio had a software glitch in the operating systems that ran their utilities. And they had a simple problem. They had a couple of power lines that touched together in high winds and shorted. And this is a common problem. It's easily corrected by rerouting a power. But because of this software glitch, the operators didn't know it. They didn't know this was going on. They didn't get the alarms. And so this power outage then cascaded down to the next power systems. And mm-hmm. in the end, there was 256 power stations had to shut down. This impacted millions of people on the East Coast. Now, I don't know how many people are going to remember that, but that was in 2003.
Well, I remember that. And then, of course, I was in Pennsylvania. We had a power outage. It was a cascading event. And I remember exactly. The pictures on New York City of people walking across the bridge. And power was out there for a while, but you're saying that was such a simple fix. All they had to do was reroute power, but because they didn't get the alerts, it caused basically a blackout of the East Coast.
Exactly. What if a hacker had gotten into the system and just turned off the alarms? And we've already had numerous examples of utility systems being hacked in other countries. I mean, they have had multiple times in other countries where remote hackers were able to access the control systems and shut down the grid in those countries. Well, I'm not just worried about them shutting down the grid. I'm worried about them taking over control. They can cause, problems with brownouts. They can turn the power on and off rapidly, which is going to pretty much destroy everybody's appliances. So there's a lot more that can happen with the utility grid than just turning it off. As a matter of fact, that might be the least concern of what they can do. They can shift power from one power plant to another out of phase. You know, I was involved with an engineering study back in the 80s, and we had a chiller plant of a hospital, had a 3-inch drive shaft. This motor was like 500 horsepower. It's the size of an automobile, electric motor, and running a chiller, and because the maintenance people were switching back and forth when they tested the generators each week, they weren't checking to make sure that the generator and the grid were operating in phase before they switched it back. And it twisted that shaft completely in two. It looked like, a paperclip. And there wasn't any flaws in the metal. There was no defects. But this is a 3-inch hardened steel shaft that twisted off. Now, we have motors that size running lift gates at dams and running high-speed elevators and high-rise buildings. I mean, what would happen if that happened to those types of motors? What damage could they do? Or what if they could take over control of the lift gates and just literally cause dams to open wide open? I mean, so there's many more things that can happen to the grid than just turning it off.
No, absolutely. And what you said, I've heard reports on a number from a number of different news agencies about the dormant malware that could already be in a number of these, that they've actually found in a number of these power grids across the U.S. And that is very frightening, in the fact that these hackers can, at the flick of a switch when they want to, decide today's the day they're going to cause havoc on the world and just do that with the back doors already in there for them to be able to do it much easier. But you also say that much of the software that runs our grid is pre-internet software. That's true?
Yes. What I talk about in the book is SCADA, which is supervisory control and data acquisition. And back in the early 90s and late 80s, I did a lot of work for government agencies, and all of these facilities had need for different types of very basic computer controls of industrial processes and, operating assembly lines and building heating and cooling systems. And so there was multiple manufacturers that were making this equipment. But the problem was none of this equipment was compatible with each other. So a company could spend $1 million for controls to operate an assembly line, and 3 years later that the manufacturer could go out of business, or he would charge so much the guy wants to go to somewhere else, and this equipment wasn't compatible with each other. So there was a lot of pressure put on the industry to come up with some standardized control systems. And in the 90s, they developed SCADA. And the good thing about SCADA is it's incredibly reliable. The SCADA equipment is very durable, very rugged, but that's also the problem because a lot of this stuff was put in the 90s before anybody was using internet, yet now so many people that own this equipment are connecting it up with the internet and being able to remotely control a utility grid from another state or a lift station or a water treatment plant. It's very convenient, but the problem is it never was developed with any kind of security protocols. It was always made for where one device is talking to another device over a hard wire. It wasn't ever set up to be using the internet or cell phone technology or, you know, web controls to connect this stuff together.
Wow.
So all of it, and it's not just the grid. I mean, these same controls are used at all your water treatment plants, your sewer treatment plants, utility grids, assembly lines, dams, railroad controls. It's a very robust way of controlling, computer controlling any kind of mechanical systems, but it's also certainly subject to hacking, and that's where I see another potential for impacting the grid.
And with this world of the Internet of Things, everything interconnected to the point where from your phone you can turn on, you know, appliances and lights in your own house from remote locations. And when I learned that the software that runs our grid is pre-internet, and you're not even only talking about electricity, you're talking about another of other essential functions. And then we see stories, and I don't mean to be crude, but the one that comes to mind, the sex robots. So they can create, you know, this technology to create all these crazy things, you know, the technocracy, the you know, unifying man with machine, but they won't update, you know, this other systems and softwares to be technologically safer and more efficient. It kind of makes you scratch your head and wonder why. Folks, our guest is Jeff Yago. He's an author, and his book is called Lights On. You can get that at the WorldNet Daily Superstore. And their link to the WorldNet Daily Superstore is right on the Hagman Report, right on the top of Hagman Report. Use the promo code Hagman. And we're we got about 25 minutes left of the interview. And Jeff, I want to make sure that you have a number of solutions that we're going to talk about. So I want to make sure we save enough time for that. But I want to use this time to showcase two of our sponsors who sponsor the Hagman Report, which is SolarC. They are a company. Folks, go to solarc.us. They're a company that deals with portable solar equipment, and it's a great company. You can get a hold of them. They'll give you a consultation, and if their equipment isn't right for you, they will point you in the right direction to somebody who has exactly what you need. But they not only get into, you know, the solar power of the homes, but also what you need to power individual appliances. And they do the consultations there, folks. Go to solarc.us, as well as Greenovative. Greenovative is a company that does rechargeable batteries, and they have these awesome GMAG power cell packages for Hagman and Hagman listeners. And you contact Alan Riggs at Greenovative, and they'll set you up with, you know, enough material to rechargeable batteries for years and years and years at a very low price and a very efficient, easy way to do it. These are two of our sponsors that deal directly with getting away from the grid and taking some ability to have reliable and efficient power methods outside of the main power grid. And both companies, you have SolarC that is EMP resistant, I believe, and Greenovative, which is the product is EMP proof. What it does is recharge the AA batteries. And these are some of the solutions that Jeff's going to get into. Now, Jeff, we can get right into the solutions with the time we have left, but I'm also curious about the Santa Clara incident.
California. It's what, about 2013, I believe. It's a Medkeff Power Systems. What happened there was, I'm not sure if the listeners will even know about it, but because it was really covered up.
Yeah, I didn't even hear about it.
It happened in 2013, and in Medkeff Power Substation in California is a typical electrical substation that everybody sees when they're driving between cities. It's just, you see some transformers out in the field, and the only security was a high chain link fence around it, and it did have some security cameras, and that's it. But it's in the middle of nowhere. It's not near anything. Well, anyway, one night, the substation basically caught fire, and there were 17 transformers were destroyed. And when they went in to investigate, they found out that there was an underground utility tunnel that they had first gone in and cut the fiber optic cables between the cities, so no alarms could be sent. So nobody knew the substation was being impacted at all. So that was clearly pre-planned. They knew which cables to cut, and they had the tools to cut them. Now remember, it's surrounded by cameras. But later when they reviewed the cameras footage, there was nobody visible in the camera feed. They also found later around the substation little piles of rocks in multiple places, which the normal police didn't even notice it, but when the federal government came in to investigate those, they knew those were pre-positioned locations for shooters. Then showing them where to be, simply it's going to be in the middle of the dark, at night, so it'd be very dark. And so they found over 100 shell casings. None of them had fingerprints on them, and there was nobody visible in the video feed, but these were marksmen. They shot up the cooling fins on the transformers, not the transformers. The cooling fins, if you see a typical high-voltage transformer, it looks like radiators sticking out the side. Well, the transformers are full of oil, and they get very hot. So they use both fans and these cooling fins to help lower the temperature and cool the oil. Well, they only shot these fins, which caused it to take a while for the transformers to heat up and melt down. It gave them plenty of time to escape. And as I said, they'd already cut the security fiber optic controls or communication system. So by the time the utility grid and the police were aware of this, all 17 transformers in the substation had been destroyed. Now, all of this was reported as teenager vandalism, and they implied it was somebody had their father's squirrel gun taking, plunk shots at the wow. at these transformers that's what the national news is. And it's only been about 6 months when they spilled the beans of what really happened. But up until about 6 months ago, everybody that ever heard about this really thought it was a bunch of teenagers out on a Saturday night having a good time, and this was done with a .22 rifle. These are very high-powered rifles with extreme accuracy to do this. And whether it was a flag event or people practicing for just how to go about doing this on a wide scale, I don't know, but I do know that one of the government studies that I referred you to earlier has indicated if 6 substations of very specific locations were taken out at the same time, we'd lose the grid on half the United States, and it could take months to get it back. Of course, they're not going to identify which 6 substations, but they did say they only needed 6 to be destroyed at the same time. So, if this is a black flag event, who knows, or whether this was terrorists practicing and just seeing what it would take to do this, that hasn't been determined. But as of today, and I checked on the internet today, the FBI has said this was definitely not terrorist related. So, I don't know how they can say
government. What you just described, and I've never heard the details of this before, but from my experience, what you just described is well beyond terrorism, unless these people really studied every component of the grid and how, what makes it work. And I mean, this was precision. This was done with extreme knowledge and precision, whether it was a beta test to see the response of, you know, the government or whatnot. It sounds more like something like that to me than terrorism, and definitely not kids playing around with any guns at all.
Well, I agree with you, but that's why it was reported by the news media, and there's been multiple cases since then. I mean, there was a high voltage tower, carrying power lines, it has over 100 volts at the bottom that were cut, and this tower fell over. It fell across the railroad tracks, and the train came through and severed the power line. I mean, you know, this tower was, you know, over 200 feet tall, and yet they knew when they cut the bolts to leave five. And they left five bolts long, which held it up until there was a strong wind, and they had plenty of time to get away. I mean, you know, 2 years ago, there was a power plant where somebody set off or put a explosive device under a 50,000 gallon diesel fuel tank. I mean, these things are going on right now in this country. They interviewed heads of electrical utilities, and they say they receive 10,000 attempts of hacking every week. I mean, 10,000 attempts of people trying to remotely access their utility control system. So this is not being reported in the news, and this is an ongoing problem that's not being addressed. And that's why I say I think we are definitely going to be facing not just a power outage, but a true grid down event. And that's going to impact a lot of people for a long time, not just a couple of days.
No, you're very right, folks. The book Lights On, you can get it at the WorldNet Daily Superstore. Author is Jeff Yeago. He is our guest, and we have about, 15 minutes left. And I know you have a number of solutions, Jeff, in your book Lights On that we want to get into. Is it safe to say we can take the next 15 minutes and get into these?
Absolutely. That would be great if we could do that. As I said, I've got many years' experience dealing with all types of power systems, and most of these were extremely expensive. And, you know, when I was dealing with residential systems and small commercial, you're still talking about large sums of money. And a lot of people, you know, can't afford that. And they're just looking for simple ways to have some backup power. Now, you mentioned backup power to a typical prepper, and the first thing he tells me is, oh, I've got a generator.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, a generator, he's lucky if he's got a week's worth of fuel. Generators are very nice and convenient, and, you know, I own three, so I'm not against owning a generator, but I view this as just a very short-term solution, and probably you could be even worse off, because the guy without a generator is during a power outage, he's immediately starting to deal with the problem, where the guy with the generator is just happily going along as if nothing has happened until all of a sudden he's out of fuel. And then he's in the same boat. And if we have a grid down event, he's not going to be able to run down to the gas station and get some more fuel. I mean, we're talking about could be 200 or 300 miles around him. He's not going to be able to get, any fuel for his generator. So again, I was looking for other solutions. What is a way a person who can't afford a large, solar power system, and Tom Brennan with Solar Arc is a friend of mine, and we've spoken together at a number of events, and I certainly recommend his products. As not only he has some EMP proof solar equipment, which is the only company in the United States that I know of that can say that, but he also has solar systems that are battery backup, and that's more the direction that I recommend. It's not just a grid-tied solar system to reduce your electrical bill, which is what most people are installing, but a system that can actually continue to operate if there's a power outage and without a generator. But we're still looking for even less expensive solutions. And so when I was caught in a basement of a store a few years ago with absolutely no light at all, even though I I have a LED flashlight on every key ring I own. My wife was driving the car that day and dropped me off, so she had the car and the car keys and the light. So I was in a basement of this large old store when the lights were shut off, and this was one of those stores divided up into little sections, and I didn't think I was ever going to get out of there alive. It was just impossible. And so I'm an advocate that everybody should have a flashlight on them. It's just a very simple thing, but my book takes every item in your home and identifies anything that requires electricity that won't operate when the grid goes down, and comes up with a simple solution for that one device. So each chapter addresses a different thing in your home. For example, I discuss simple ways to have backup emergency lighting that runs on battery power. I discuss backup power for people that need CPAP machines, for example, medical devices that will need electricity when the grid goes down. Well, everything that I have discussed in the book, whether it's to run, charge up a cell phone or to operate a small refrigeration equipment to keep medicine cold, each chapter is a different subject of a appliance or device that you would need in your home. And if you're in a power outage that lasts weeks or months, some of the things you're going to need are lighting, at least in some rooms. You're going to need a radio that can operate on batteries. You're going to need a way to pump water, especially if you have a well system. So that's what I've done, is I went out and identified every possible device I could find that ran on batteries. And then I took those and looked at which ones were better suited for somebody in a power outage. And then I concentrate on trying to standardize on the same battery sizes. So you certainly don't want to have a lot of battery operated appliances in your home in a power outage and no way to charge them in, 15 different sizes of battery. So I have chapters on what are the best rechargeable batteries to get. And of course, if you have, let's say you have an AM radio for an emergency that runs off of a couple of AA batteries, you can charge those AA batteries with a small solar charger, which costs maybe $35. You can charge it with if you have a cigarette lighter for your car adapter to charge it off of a car or RV or boat battery, anything like that. You can also charge it with the grid or the generator. So unlike an AC appliance, say a microwave oven or a television that typically runs on household electricity, grid power, if you lose the grid, that device is not going to work at all. If you have a device that runs off of batteries, you can run it with the grid, with the generator, with a solar charger, from your car. I mean, there's multiple ways you can keep those, operational. And this is simple. It's they're very inexpensive devices. And I'm not saying, convert your house to battery power. I'm saying, though, you can find some of the devices that will really be helpful if you are in extended power outage. You don't need to run a generator. And, you don't have to worry about if you have, say, an inverter fail that was running off of batteries, then all your AC appliances are not going to work. My approach means if something fails, you're losing one device or one appliance, not everything. And so, that certainly is a big advantage in an emergency situation. So,
absolutely. I mean, folks, just imagine the whole grid being down, but you're able to keep things like a water pump going and your refrigerator going. Obviously in a situations like that, you're not going to really care about your TV. But as you said, even your cell phones, just about every cell phone now has a flashlight on it. If you can just keep that powered up, that could help a lot. You talk about simple things that you can buy for $50 from Amazon that make a huge difference. It seems like Amazon is the most popular, the new Walmart and grocery store all rolled into one. Do you have some examples of what you can get off Amazon that would make that much of a difference?
The appendix in my book has over 200 devices that are in the $25 to $50 price range. They have everything from, you know, battery powered baby bottle warmers, you know, anything you can imagine you can get if you look for it. And they're fairly inexpensive. And the other thing is, a typical household appliance or device, radio, TV, whatever, they're not really energy efficient. I mean, even the ones that are, Energy Star rated, that's not enough efficiency for what I'm talking about in a grid down event. We want appliance that sips electricity, you know, just tiny right. amounts. And so, the guy that makes the toaster or the television, you know, he doesn't need to put any extra money in the development costs or the material costs to make it the most energy efficient possible. All he has to do is meet the, you know, these Energy Star guidelines, which are voluntary, and he can put the label on there and he's good to go. Well, for example, if you make a battery powered camera, and I used to have some that would literally eat batteries. I mean, I would go through mm-hmm. pocketfuls of batteries when I'm doing site investigations and in a day. Well, now you can get a, you know, I have a little Canon camera that has a little square, battery in it that, I mean, I can take 200 or 300 pictures before I need to recharge it. So the guys making the battery appliances, if they're not efficient, and I mean extremely efficient, and they don't give you really long battery life, they're going to be out of business. Their product is not going to make it in the market. So, when you think about, what's available, look at an RV. You know, we have an RV and, everything in an RV runs off of a 12-volt battery. I mean, we have a flat screen television. We have a satellite receiver. We have an internet, modem. We have, lights. We have the fan for the furnace. We have a stereo AM, FM radio, a CD, a DVD player. These are all 12-volt DC appliances, flat-screen television, 12-volt DC. So you know, we talked about Amazon, but there's an RV and boating supply store in about every city, and these are excellent places to find some of these 12-volt DC appliances. And, you know, I strongly encourage people to take a look at what's available there, because you know, a 12-volt battery, I mean, it's you have that in every car. So there's another easy solution to a number of these power problems that I'm talking about. So again, it's might take a little bit more searching, but I think people would be amazed at of just, you know, just a very few devices that they pick up. I mentioned some LED lights, you know, an AM, FM radio, you know, maybe a way to pump some water. I mean, you know, there's a $35 pump you can get that, you put in a 5-gallon bucket of warm water and you can have a shower. And I've used these and it's amazing. You know, the shower is better than the shower in my RV. Hmm. And you know, in 5 minutes, you can certainly hose yourself down. Stop, lather up, and then rinse. I mean, I'm not saying you're going to be out in your yard taking a shower, but in a power outage, you can certainly stand in the shower stall and keep some water on an outdoor barbecue grill or something like that and have a pretty decent shower and when your well pump is dead. So that's what the book does. It goes through all these really simple ways and describes all these amazing devices that you can get. Again, all of them are very inexpensive. So I'm taking a different track from my many years of seeing the complex and expensive systems, and I'm trying to bring some really low cost solutions for the average guy that is wanting to do some preparation. And certainly it should be as much of a consideration as people worried about, you know, stockpiling food and stockpiling water. But you know, it'd be awfully uncomfortable if you're sitting in a dark apartment or a dark house for weeks at a time and your cell phone doesn't work and your radio and TV don't work and you don't know what's going on outside your front door. So
Yeah.
You know, you can also,
and Jeff, if I can, what you're doing is really helpful, because for people like me who are just worried about, you know, being able to pay the electric bill and being able to keep the roof over your head and paying your regular bills, there's not a lot of extra to worry about, you know, as you said, the expensive you know, ways to, you know, whether it's the solar systems or whatever it is. I'm in the category of the as you say, the poor man's way of simple solutions if we lose power. And those sometimes can be also not only the best way to go, but sometimes the most effective. And as you said, with the generators, I mean, the one thing when I think about generators is people will not only notice the lights on in your house when everywhere else is dark, but the noise of those things alone can draw people. And I know that there's other generators out there that keep the noise down. But
well, they tend to walk away a lot of times, too, on a dark night when they're running.
Yeah.
I think... one more example I'd like to present before we go is just it's one of the chapters in my book. I talk about some emergency lighting tricks, and my best one that I really like is buying really good quality solar yard lights. I don't mean the ones you see at the checkout line that are $3 a piece, but the ones that are, you know, have a much brighter output. They typically cost about $10 to $15 a piece. You sold two or three in a package. And when you put them out in your yard, instead of sticking them in the ground, you put a small piece of pipe or conduit in the ground, sticks up out of the ground. You put the solar lights out there in your yard doing their normal function. But inside the house, you just take a couple of blocks of wood and put a little short piece of the same size pipe, you know, drill a hole and put the pipe in the middle of the block of wood. And so then, you know, if you have a power outage, all you have to do is walk out in the yard and lift these solar lights that are fully charged every day, bring them in, put them in the little stand. I have a picture in the book, and they look like table lamps.
That's
and, of
great.
Course, this is something the kid can do. The kids can bring them in the evening and light. They can put one in each room and the rooms that you want to light up, and then in the morning they take them back out and put them in the yard to charge up again. So, again, I really try to present a number of very inexpensive solutions for people that maybe they just wouldn't think about it. But when you describe it to them, they say, well, yeah, I can do that. That's simple.
Yeah. And that idea you gave me that you just gave, I just wrote down the solar yard lights. That's a fantastic idea. Mr. Yeager, we are out of time. Jeff Yeager is our guest. The book Lights On, you can get it at WorldNet Daily Superstore. I'm sure you can get it at Amazon too. If you go to and get it through WorldNet Daily Superstore, use the promo code Hagman. And Jeff, I want to thank you and your wife for being listeners to the show, even before your interview. It's been a great interview, and I hope we can have you back on, because there's a lot of stuff we didn't cover. And I can't wait to read your book. I haven't read it yet, but I'm definitely going to get it with, just reading the list of solutions that you have. I'm sure there is plenty in there, for everybody, no matter what side of the, you know, spectrum you're on. So thank you.
Well, again, I appreciate you guys having me on, and it is true, we are very long-time listeners and have enjoyed your shows. We listen to them every evening, and I don't think we've watched television for two or three years because of it, so we certainly enjoy it.
Well, God bless you, and thank you so much. You have a great evening. It was a fantastic interview, and folks, that'll do it for us this week. Of course, we'll be here ready to go if anything happens over the weekend. But if not, you will see us on the Hagman Daily Show Monday and the Doug Hagman Show Monday morning. Until then, stay safe. God bless. Have a great evening.